from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, President Trump is visiting Kenosha, Wisconsin, as he takes a more aggressive stance against the lawlessness that has been allowed to spread in several major cities. Just how aggressive can President Trump get on upholding order in these cities, which have plunged into chaos? And how can these mayors and governors who are facilitating this lawlessness by refusing to uphold the law be held accountable? And if they can, by whom? Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney and senior fellow at the National Review Institute, is here with us in just a moment. And political pollster John McLaughlin is here to tell us what the polling numbers really show us about the presidential race. And we'll also talk about whether or not the riots are impacting voters' opinions in this presidential election cycle. And my good friend Jeff Landry, Attorney General for Louisiana, will give us an update on the recovery and relief effort underway in the wake of Hurricane Laura. And is it just me, or are these natural disasters becoming more frequent and more intense? Well, I don't think it's the result of too many SUVs. I do think we need to pay attention. As Christians, does the Bible give us any guidance on how we should understand these events and how we should respond? FRC's David Clausen will join me for a conversation that I am certain will get the God deniers all worked up. That's coming up on this edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or on Parler, it's at T Perkins. By the way, let me remind you, Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Pray, Vote, Stand, Episode 2. You can find out more by going to PrayVoteStand.org. And by the way, take the challenge. Are you ready to take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand as we move into what may be the most important election in the history of our republic? PrayVoteStand.org. Take the challenge. As I mentioned, President Trump is in Kenosha, Wisconsin, as the city, like a number of others, has plunged into civil disorder. Riots and protests in major cities across the country have been unwavering over the past few months. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden thinks the riot should be viewed as no harm, no foul. The only problem is there has been great harm to many business owners and families and cities as these riots drag out. So what authority does President Trump have to step in? Join me now to talk about the actions that can be taken to address this breakdown in order across the country is former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York and senior fellow at the National Review Institute, Andy McCarthy. Andy, welcome back to the program.
Tony, great to be with you.
Now, the president does have authority. What authority does he have, and what can he do to address this disorder, the civil disorder that seems to be just unleashed in so many cities across the country?
Well, Tony, the way our system is conceived, the president has authority over interstate and international matters, as well as national security, particularly border security. So that's in the constitutional framework as legislation's been enacted since really the beginning of the republic. The president has gotten more authority from Congress in terms of being able to act to quell insurrection and widespread violence. So the bottom line is most of the limitations that we rely on in terms of what the president's authority is and how it interacts with the state authorities are more political than legal. There's no real doubt that the president has whatever authority he needs when order has broken down to reestablish order. And I've made the argument he not only has the power, he has the obligation to do that because the Constitution guarantees the people of the state security against invasion and a Republican form of government. So if that breaks down, the president, in taking care that the laws be faithfully executed and fulfilling his authority under Article 4 of the Constitution, where the federal government has made this guarantee to the state governments, he's got plenty of authority. The issue is it a politically wise thing to do, and how successful can it be, depending on how much cooperation you're going to get from the state authorities?
And that's very good to point out, Andy, because I think the authority of the executive has grown over time. As you said, Congress has given them more and more authority. I'm not so sure that I think that's a good thing because it it absolves local leaders of their responsibility. And that's where I want to focus for just a moment, where the fact that the president has to step in. What happens to these mayors or these governors who refuse to maintain order? I mean, they're facilitating this lawlessness. What can be done? Isn't this malfeasance in office? Who can hold them accountable?
Yeah, I think it is malfeasance. But again, the sad reality is that, and I don't think this should be a sad reality. It's probably a comment on how we govern ourselves these days. But the controls on the state actors are political as well. So, for example, if they don't do their jobs, they ought to be recalled. You know, they should be impeached. You know, they can't be arrested for not doing their jobs. It's not a federal crime for a state official to be
an idiot,
be incompetent. Right. So, you know, there's certain things that they can do that if they're, if they violate federal corruption statutes, you can go after them. But for being a moron, it's unfortunately not a crime. Maybe we should say it's fortunately not a crime. I don't know.
Yeah, because the prisons will be full.
Yeah, yeah. So I really think it's not only political. The point that you're making, which is a really good one, again, is that what it's possible for the president to do is not a matter of law. It's really a matter of the political conditions in the state, which means we want these authorities to cooperate with each other. And the political environment we're in is that some of them are allowing order to break down worse than it otherwise would for political reasons, because I think they think it helps them in the election.
Right. I agree with that. And I am reluctant to see the power of the executive branch expand, regardless of who's in there, because at some point in time, there'll be someone who may use that inappropriately. I mean, I was not a big supporter of the Patriot Act because I knew there would be a time when there would be abuses to the provisions of that law, which I would say were abused by the Obama administration. So I think there's a precedent that could be set here, and I completely appreciate what you're saying, and I'm grateful for the candor that the law's on the side of the president. It becomes a political issue. Do you want to set a precedent of federal involvement in local jurisdiction just because you have mayors and governors in some cases refusing to uphold the law for political purposes? That's the bottom line.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. The way I look at it is slightly different. I always make a distinction. I wish I had thought of this myself. Someone corrected me years ago about this, and I've always thought it was a good distinction. I prefer limited government to small government. And what I mean by that is, if it's a job we need the president to do, then I want the president to have as much power as he needs to have in order to do it. So the distinction would be, the difference between talking about the national security of the United States in terms of if you have an enemy coming across the border versus do I want the president to be able to issue a mask mandate that everybody in America has to wear a mask? Mm-hmm. You know, I think those are two very opposite things. We don't want the president usurping the authority of the states to run their internal affairs because we have a federalist system and the states are sovereign for very good reasons. But on the other hand, if it's something that we need the president to do because no one else can do it, which is why we have a president in many ways, then I think we need to have the president to have as much power as he needs to have, including calling out the military to meet those kinds of challenges. That's the reason the framers created the office in the first place.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. But I think you would agree with the president shouldn't have to do this.
Yep.
He has the authority to do it.
I don't think we've had this such sweeping breakdown of order that you can say that you have. I think you have insurrectionist activity, but I think it would be extravagant to call this an insurrection at this point. It could become one, but I don't think we're there yet.
I mean, you
have the problems.
You have kind of distinguished the elements here that, in order to enforce the rule of law, it means uphold the law, you have to have order. And what's at stake here is order. I mean, we're losing order in these cities. So that makes it impossible to enforce the law when you don't have order, correct?
Yeah, it's a critical distinction. I mean, if you just take New York City, where I come from, has probably the biggest police force in the country, 38,000 strong, I think, when they're completely staffed up. And as we've seen in the generation from about the beginning of the 1990s up until the last few years, we've had unprecedented domestic tranquility in modern times. They've done a great job of keeping the rule of law. But if the rule of law is lost, you don't have enough resources, even with a police department of that size, to reestablish it. The police departments can enforce a law if you have order as a precondition. But if you lose order, that's where I really think you have to start thinking about the president coming in and using military resources as opposed to law enforcement resources. Because if order breaks down, how do you enforce the law? It's enough that you can, you know, to try to prevent the rioting and the general breakdown in society that we're seeing. The thought that you could, while you're trying to do all that, do ordinary law enforcement is just fanciful.
And that is the argument to convince people like me who really don't want, you know, the president to step in. Right. Although I'm not challenging the fact that he has the authority. It's just that it's more that political thing. I don't like that precedent being set. But as you pointed out, if order is not restored, then people are going to try and protect themselves, as we're already seeing happening, and they're going to confront the mobs, and then we're really at a risk of anarchy, are we not?
Yeah, I really think that's right. On my own podcast on National Review with Rich Lowry this week, one of the things I was grousing about is, you know, it's all well and good to say you don't want the president to do this and let the local authorities handle it, but if they don't handle it, what you end up with is a situation like this 17-year-old kid,
right,
who shouldn't have been out there. I'm not
agree.
I don't think they have evidence that he committed intentional murder, but it's irresponsible for him to have been out there. And the reason he's out there is because the government, whether you're talking about the federal government, the state government, the local government, they're not doing their job, which is security.
Agreed.
And this is the kind of powder keg we're playing with.
So there is a breakdown because, and I agree with you, I think it's political. I think they're hoping that this would somehow bring down the Trump reelection. And so chaos is spreading across cities in America. People are dying. And so the president has to step in. I mean, if we're to maintain order and the enforcement of the law, the president has to step in. I don't see any other options.
I think that's right, but I also think that every place is different. So, he should go first where he gets the most cooperation.
Yes, agreed, agreed. But I also think that those citizens in those cities need to hold these mayors accountable, and the citizens in those states need to hold those governors accountable as well. Andy, out of time. Thanks so much for joining us today. As always, great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, coming up next, what do the polling numbers really show, really, really show about the presidential race? We'll talk to pollster John McLaughlin right after this. Don't go away. Back with more Washington Watch in just a moment.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. You're listening to Washington Watch, the website, TonyPerkins.com. Let me remind you again, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Pray, Vote, Stand. Find out more, go to PrayVoteStand.org. Take the challenge to pray for our nation, to vote your biblical values, and to stand for truth, even in the face of the hostile opposition. All right, how many of you have participated in a presidential poll? Probably not many, but you see the polls every day in the headlines, on television, in the newspapers, online. Can we believe these polls? Now, I took enough statistics in college to realize that these things can be kind of orchestrated to get the outcome that you desire in many cases. So what are we to make of the presidential poll, the polls that we see? If you look at them, it would look as if President Trump is way behind, that Joe Biden's going to be the next president, just as Hillary Clinton was going to be the president 4 years ago. Well, joining me now to kind of go behind the curtain to see what is up with all of these polls is John McLaughlin with McLaughlin Associates. He has actually worked with the Trump campaign. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, pleasure to be with you.
And I should mention they've done polling for us as well. They do good work. Let's talk a little bit about how these polling numbers can show such. They're so much different. I mean, one day Trump is 2 points behind. Next day he's 12 points behind. What are some of these polling firms doing to get what I would describe as desired outcomes?
Well, there's you've hit the nail on the head where they had a bias. They had a bias 4 years ago. And, from May of 2016, when it looked like President Trump had sealed the nomination after he won Indiana, until Election Day, there was over 170 polls, national polls taken. That was more national in scope, even though you vote state by state with electoral votes. But we'd only won 13 of those polls. And they hit polls in October. We were losing by double digits. And granted, a lot of times I tell people, like, God let us win, but we won by 76,000 votes or 78,000 votes, pardon me, really in three states, we won a very close election, and it was a decisive electoral win. But it was 46,000 votes in Pennsylvania, 22,000 votes in Wisconsin, and 10,000 votes in Michigan that made the difference. And, you know, the polls at the end, remember the Hillary electoral lock? They said there was an electoral lock. There was no way we could win. Even on election day, 538 New York Times, they had an 85% chance of losing. The exit polls came in and around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and they said it was over. We weren't going to win. And fortunately, the president never believed them. The president was campaigning 5 or 6 cities a day through that whole week. He would get up at 6 in the morning, campaign until midnight at night. And we were able to get enough voters out that they didn't believe the polls and that we were going to win. So 4 years ago, they didn't think we could win. So they kind of ignored us. This time around, they're afraid we're going to win and that President Trump will get reelected. So the establishment media is rigging the polls, basically, where they a lot of the polls that are online or that they you see at the websites, whether it's 538 or whether it's Real Clear Politics, these media polls, they're underestimating the number of Republicans, and they're doing it intentionally.
Right.
The best polls will say you'll have likely voters, and you'll have a model based on the 2016 turnout, which was a record 139 million voters. And it'll be higher this time because of the challenges the country's facing. So you'll have more than 150 million voters, but there's really 237 million eligible voters in the country. And there are people that don't want to vote. So the media interviews polls of what they call adults, or they call registered voters. They call people without a list. They just randomly dial them. And they'll have, like there was a Yahoo News poll out Sunday that said the president was gaining from 10 down to 6 down based on their last poll. When you looked at the poll, it was 41% Democrat and only 26% Republican. We were 33% on Election Day in 2016, according to the exit polls. We were 33% on Election Day, even in a bad year for Republicans, on Election Day 2018. And for some reason, Yahoo News thinks we're going to be 7 points below where we were 2 years ago and 4 years ago. So since the president gets over 90% of the Republican vote, every point you take the Republicans down, you're taking the president down a point. So that poll that had us down 6 or 7, it was like 47-40, something like that, they had us winning the independents by 10 points. They had President Trump winning the suburbs by 2 points. If we're winning the independents by 10 points and we're winning nationally and we're winning the suburbs by 2 points, we're going to win. And you had other polls that are doing it correctly, likely voter polls. And this has been building for 2 weeks since the Democrats had their convention. The president has been very focused for the last month, doing the coronavirus briefings every day, discipline, letting people know what they need to do to help get the spread of the virus down. The Democrat convention was unbelievably pessimistic, running America down, really about the virus. Things are getting worse, very negative against the president. And we started to see the polls moving our ways, like a lot of the battleground states during that time were really moving our ways, whether it was a CNBC poll of likely voters or some of these other polls. Certainly last week during the Republican convention, and by the way, after Biden, before his convention, when he picked Harris, there was an ABC poll with only 25% Republicans in it. And when he asked about Harris, they said most Americans, only 37% said she shares our values. Only 38% said she cares about people like us. And 38% agreed to 27% that she's too liberal. So our message that the radical left had taken over Biden to resign that unity statement. And then he went on board with Harris. Mm-hmm. Polls have moved our way for 2 weeks.
John, hold on right there. We're up against a break. I want to come back and we want to finish this conversation. I also want to talk about the rationale for this, what they're actually trying to accomplish by kind of, if I can use the term, cooking the polls, what they're trying to accomplish. But then I also want to talk about the riots that are taking place and how that might impact the opinion of voters. All right, folks, John McLaughlin, my guest, we're going to finish our conversation about these presidential polls and what to make of them. And we're going to be joined a little bit later by Attorney General Jeff Landry of Louisiana. So don't go away. Back with more Washington Watch in just a moment.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has released a new 3-part series titled Three Ways to Read the Bible. In this series, Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth through studying and applying the Bible's text. Now's the time to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible and learning what it says about God, humanity, and the power of Scripture. During the season of isolation, devote time to the Lord and seek out His meaning for you. In times of crisis and any time, this blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through His Word. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but your heart. To learn more, visit frcblog.com. That's frcblog.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, tonyperkins.com. John McLaughlin, my guest, talking about presidential polling and what can we make of it. Now, John, let me just summarize. It's who they poll, meaning, you know, you have a more accurate read of the public if you actually poll likely voters, correct?
Correct. A lot of the media polls will ask if you're likely to vote, and then they'll keep you in the poll if you tell them no, and that right. waters down the number of Republicans and hurts the president in terms of the results we have.
There's another factor that's at play in this election cycle, and it's how people respond to the pollsters, because there's this tendency, not, you know, especially as the media and others are so hostile toward Trump. People are afraid in some cases to admit that they're voting for Trump, which leads to underpolling of Trump support. Is that correct?
Right. And what you'll see is a lot of times you'll ask in a poll, you'll say who they're voting for president. And if they think it's the media, you'll see Biden might be ahead by a little. And then there might be a little bit of an undecided. And then when you ask them who they think is going to win, all of a sudden Trump's ahead. Well, the undecided voters that think Trump's going to win are probably not telling the media who they're going to vote for because they think it's socially unacceptable to say so.
So that's kind of like that old thing: is I have a friend who has this, this issue. So it's like my friend's voting for Trump. I'm not saying I'm voting for Trump, but I think my friend is voting for Trump.
Right, and that went on 4 years ago, and it's even more pronounced today. But there are good polls. I mean, the Zoologi poll last week had us up 50, had us with a 52% job approval. Rasmussen report showed us.
But that poll, John, kind of accommodates for that that hidden Trump voter. The way they pull out, so that people don't feel intimidated by the pollster, and they do different right. methods of getting to the truth.
Yes, and that was an online poll, and they do it unbiased, and they got their results. And there was an IVR poll, which is a voice-activated poll by Democracy Institute. 80% was on cell phones.
on Sunday. They have the president up 3 points, 48-45 national, and up 7 points in the battleground states, which and there's other polls like that. Emerson College has the president going from behind a couple points to ahead. So there are some pollsters that are trying to do it accurately among likely voters with representative samples of Republicans. But then you get NBC and you get Quinnipiac poll, who's like the worst offender. And they ought to stick to college. And then you get like the USC poll. USC, you know, they should be playing football again.
Let me talk about that USC Dornsife poll, because they actually went back and changed the calculations based on what they said happened 4 years ago. So they actually making it more difficult to do an apples to apples comparison.
Right. And it's also they have a panel of 6,000 people, and then they're constantly asking them. The panel's not big enough online to do that survey. It's very hard to do online. You said you took stats. It's very hard to do online surveys without a huge universe of people to invite in via email or text. They don't have it. So it's sensitized.
Before we run out of time, John, I want to focus on the why of this, because you see that CNN, MSNBC, any of them, pick something out of the alphabet. What they will do is they will latch on to a negative headline from a poll, because that has the effect of suppressing voter turnout for Trump. Because people, they want to be on, quote unquote, the winning side, and they feel like they're maybe out of step if, they're not in line with the prevailing numbers. And so that has an effect upon the psyche of some voters, does it not?
Well, if they tell you your candidate can't win, which they tried 4 years ago and it backfired, they're doubling down on it this time, and they're hoping that they know the Trump voters are more enthusiastic. They know we're more likely to vote. A lot of times, too, they don't even mention there's a Green Party candidate or a Libertarian candidate, because it takes away votes from Biden. So they're rigging the polls so that they could discourage us and suppress us, that we won't go out to vote. And that the polls are close when in a place like Nevada, they try to rig the election through mail-in balloting and have ballot harvesting. And this mail-in ballot people are out there suffering. That they need help from, they need their jobs back, coronavirus relief, et cetera. Schools need help. And Nancy Pelosi won't pass anything unless it has universal mail-in ballots without voter identification.
Should tell you something.
So, yeah, it tells you everything you need to know about November.
John, this is the last question, because we're almost out of time, but this may be the wrong question to ask a pollster, but what should people do with these presidential polls?
Ignore them and go vote. They should study the issues, pay attention to the debates, know what their principles are, and look at the candidates. And when you saw the convention, Donald Trump and the Republicans represent America. They will make our country prouder and our future will be better. So they should go vote. Vote for Donald Trump.
Absolutely. John McLaughlin, thanks so much for joining us. And folks, we've got resources available for you to help you make an informed, educated decision. The two-party platforms provide an excellent contrast between the two parties. I mean, put the candidates aside, that's a great contrast as well. But the principles of the party articulated very clearly in their party platforms. You can find out more about that, go to PrayVoteStand.com. Lots of resources there for you at PrayVoteStand.org. .org. Also, take the pledge while you're there. All right, when we come back, the Attorney General from my home state of Louisiana, Jeff Landry, joins us with an update on the relief efforts from the hurricane. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increased pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that'll help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/sexuality. Again, that's frc.org/sexuality.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
With horrifying acceleration in recent years, verified reports of murders, rapes, mutilations, and kidnapping of Christians in Nigeria have persistently increased. These attacks are frequently accompanied by the torching of homes, churches, villages, and agricultural fields. A July 15, 2020 headline reports that over 1,000 Nigerian Christians were killed in the first 6 months of 2020. This is in addition to 11,000 Christians who have been killed since June 2015. News stories about the assaults in Nigeria are rarely reported in mainstream media outlets. But when they are, they're regularly explained away as effects of climate change, local feuds, or religious wars for which both sides bear equal responsibility. For more information about the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, read FRC's publication, The Crisis of Christian Persecution in Nigeria, at frc.org/Nigeria.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Again, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday night, Pray, Vote, Stand, Episode 2. Find out more, go to prayvotestand.org. All right, Hurricane Laura was really one for the record books, one of the strongest hurricanes to hit Louisiana and Texas. It devastated Lake Charles and many other cities. There's been a lot of focus, obviously, on Lake Charles, most densely populated area in Louisiana, but many, many other small towns and cities were impacted by this as this kind of made an arch through Louisiana, up through the middle of State Alexandria, up to Monroe, and then out through Arkansas and on across the country back to the Atlantic. Just how is the recovery effort going, and just how bad were the outerlying parts of the state hit? Joining me now with more is the Attorney General for the state of Louisiana, Jeff Landry. Jeff, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Well, I know we were together in Lake Charles on Saturday, and I know you got a good look at Lake Charles. You were with the president, but you've also had teams working out across the state. Give our listeners a sense of, you know, you've been around for a while. You know, we go all the way back to Katrina. Give our listeners a sense of the extent of the devastation and damage here.
Oh, look, I can tell you, Tony, you know, my experience with hurricanes actually started all the way back with Hurricane Andrew back in 1991 when I worked for the sheriff's office at the time. And of course, it was great to see you with all the law enforcement folks over in Lake Charles on Sunday as well. And what, you know, look, I can tell you, this storm was completely devastating. It had a very high, tight wind radius, and it cut a path literally from one corner, the southwest corner of the state of Louisiana, clean across to the northeast section of the state. I was actually in Natchitoches and Ruston and Monroe, which are all North Louisiana towns, and the impact up there was tremendous. What has been interesting in this storm is the lack of not only electricity, which we're used to here, but in many parishes, they have no water. And of course, you know, I tell people what separates the United States from third world countries is actually the quality of water. Our water quality is what separates us. And so, you know, we need to get those water systems back up. And I can tell you, there's water systems out from one end of the state, being in the south, all the way through to the north, because those areas had never seen hurricane force winds extend as far up northward as Hurricane Laura did.
Yeah, that's one of the things. It does happen from time to time where the water systems go out, but even in Katrina, most places retained their water. Gustav, same thing. This is a unique, and in fact, you and I were texting earlier trying to get a shipment of water over to the area of De Quincy and DeRidder, Louisiana. They're without any type of drinking water. So this is a significant issue. A lot of folks on the ground, the FEMA is on the ground. You've got a number of relief agencies, Samaritan's Purse that I was with on Saturday. We've got the Baptist Relief Association. We've got Red Cross, different agencies. What is the greatest need? Is it water from your perspective right now?
Absolutely. Look, I think that water right now is a huge, huge need. And then sheltering is going to be, I think, a close second. To some of the most top priorities that people in those areas need. I can tell you, it's a little unfortunate. You know, I did have an opportunity to basically see Bobby Jindal when he was the governor of Louisiana. When I was in Congress, he was the governor, and we had a couple of storms during that period of time. And the one thing that Bobby did then was he had a great way of networking and linking up the faith-based organizations in order to help with the relief efforts. And it seems to be a little disjointed right now, and that's troubling.
Yeah, well, I actually worked with Bobby. He called me in, and I took time off just to help coordinate some of that with the faith-based communities. Let me, before we run out of time here, I do want to, and folks, I want to encourage you to support those groups that are on the ground that are working. Again, Samaritan's Purse, we had them on the program yesterday. They're doing great work, and that's who I'm working with to help facilitate the relief efforts. But the needs are acute. They're real. And one thing I like about Samaritan's Purse, they don't waste anything. But when this is going to be a long process. It's going to take a couple of years or more to rebuild. And that's where you come in, General Landry, is that you're going to make sure that the shysters don't come in.
Absolutely. Look, you know, one of the things we learned from the flood that affected South Louisiana back in 2015 was that, you know, it's unfortunate, it's evil, and it's sinful that people would take advantage of people when they're at their lowest point. But we have people that come in and try to defraud people, you know, contracting, you know, falsifying, saying, hey, look, you know, if you really want me to take care of this right now, you got to give me all of, you know, the payment up front or have the money up front, and then you never see them again. We built a great network in working with the National Center for Disaster Fraud, which is actually located in Baton Rouge. It was established after Hurricane Katrina. To basically educate people. In fact, we encourage people to go to our website at hgflandry.com. We put up actually sample contracts that they could use. We ran a program called Take a Selfie with Your Contractor. You know, when people come in and you're going to contract them to do the work, take a picture with them, take a picture of the license plate on their vehicles, things that help law enforcement bring people who will defraud you to justice quickly. And so that's some of the information that we're going to be getting out.
Well, that's pretty good. If your contractor won't take a selfie with you, it's a good indication they probably are not going to do a good job, I would imagine. And in fact, it's already happening. When I was down there this weekend talking to some folks, we already had some of those people come in. So it is unfortunate. Of course, the vast majority of people there are coming in to help and do the right thing. But there are always, just as in everything, there's a few bad apples, and that's where your agency comes in to make sure that the consumers, the citizens, the families of Louisiana are not taken advantage of. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. It's always great to talk with you, but I want to thank you for your leadership in the state and being out there on the ground trying to help coordinate and facilitate the needs of the people being met in this crisis moment.
Well, thank you, Tony. Thank you for the work that you do. We couldn't do it without you. You do a great job of helping connect Christians around the country to help other Christians and other people in need. And so I just can't thank you and all the listeners as well. We're going to be hurting. We're going to be rebuilding for quite some time. But, you know, through God's grace and perseverance, we'll get through it.
All right. We will, indeed, Lord willing. Jeff Landry, thanks so much for joining us. Attorney General of Louisiana. Find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. That's why it's encouraging to have folks like Jeff in office that are responsive and working to help meet the needs of people. All right, as I mentioned at the top of the program, you know, is it just me or are these storms becoming more frequent and more intense? I mean, beginning in 2005, you mentioned Hurricane Andrew back in 1992, really the first hurricane I had experienced. And then we came to Katrina, and then they've just been rolling one after another. The frequency has increased. The intensity has increased. In fact, in looking at some data, what we've actually found is that there has been an increase in natural disasters. In fact, you know, the disasters rose about 151% in the past 20 years compared to the previous 20-year period. Now, the good news is fewer people have died from these natural disasters. On average, about 60,000 people worldwide are killed by natural disasters. That's like 0.1% of all global deaths. So while there's been an increase, documented increase, we're not seeing as much of a loss of life, and that's partly because of better preparations and more notification. But here's what I want to talk about. As believers, as Christians— and I'm hearing this because people are saying, wow, we have all this stuff happening. We have riots. We have hurricanes. We have earthquakes. We have fires. What are we to make of this? Joining me now to talk more about this is FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, David Clawson. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Okay, let's just jump right into this. We just got a few minutes left in the program, David. But as Christians, should we be paying attention to what is happening when we look at these natural disasters?
Well, I think we absolutely should, Tony. You know, if the last few months have done anything, they've really reminded us how vulnerable and powerless we actually are. You know, if you think about it, even with all our technology, our ability to communicate, our access to information at the click of a mouse— you know, even with all of that, something like a hurricane, something like a global pandemic really reminds us that we actually aren't in control of our lives as much as we might want to think. But, you know, as Christians, we do have a category for that. The Bible explains to us that God is sovereign, that God is doesn't vacate an area when a storm comes through, but he's there in the midst of it. And I think that, you know, although, you know, these storms are so terrifying and there's so much hurt and we need to rush resources and help like we're doing with this Hurricane Laura, it's important to remember, though, that God is still with us and that he has not abandoned us. And I think that is the perspective that Christians do need to have when we go through something like this.
Now, David, there are those that immediately want to rush. Well, yeah, this is all driven by climate change, that it is the fact that we haven't, we pulled out of the Paris Accord. We're not, we're not taking the aggressive actions we should take on the climate. But I want to go to the words of Jesus found in Luke chapter 21, where he really warns his followers. He said, but when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass, but the end will not come immediately. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, famines and pestilence, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and the prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. I mean, when you run down that list, I mean, we're seeing almost all of those things happen. I mean, is this something that we should take note of, that maybe, as Jesus warned, that these are the things that are going to precede the end of time?
I think so, Tony. And, you know, as a student of the Word, as a student of theology, we study in seminary eschatology, you know, the doctrine of last things. And you run through that list from Matthew, you see Revelation talk about these things. And obviously, you know, Jesus himself says that no one knows the day, no one knows the hour, only the Father knows. However, you know, just looking at 2020 and the year that we've had with a global pandemic and the natural disasters that we're seeing, I think it is a reminder, again, like I said, you know, that, you know, we're not as in control that we think we are. I think God very well may be trying to send a signal. And I think as followers of God, as Christians, it's important for us to really make sure that we're going about the things that he's called us to do, that we are witnessing, that we're evangelizing, that we're being the light and salt that he's called us to be. Because who knows, you know, that time could be short. And so I think that the church needs to be about the business of the church, especially in these times.
But, David, you also think in part that Jesus shared this information with his disciples for the purpose, as you just said, that God is sovereign. So none of this is taking God by surprise. Therefore, we should not be anxious or fearful, but we just need to really draw closer to the Lord, make sure that we're living on purpose through his power. And this is can be a great time. For the church, if we are not filled with anxiety and fear, because we're able then to minister to those in need as occasion presents itself.
You're right, Tony. And, you know, one of the most common refrains in Scripture in the Old and New Testament is the admonition, do not be afraid, or do not fear. And I think the reason that the Scripture repeats that so often is that even as believers who have a relationship with God, I think of Peter when he was walking on the water, he took his eyes off Jesus and he became fearful. You know, so often we are tempted to be afraid. This is a frightening world that we live in. And I think that is the message that every believer in Jesus Christ needs to hear, is that God is sovereign. He's in control. All things work together for good to those who love him or called according to his purpose, and that we do need to have that spirit of courage and to not be fearful, even when we are tempted to be fearful.
And again, I think that's exactly why Jesus lays this out, is that we need to be looking for these things. As you said, no one knows the time, but we do know the seasons. We know when things begin to change and things begin to happen. And we don't need to be fearful. And that's one of the things that's really, really troubled me through this pandemic, is the fear that has gripped so many believers. We cannot operate out of fear, because fear paralyzes while faith propels us forward. And we need to operate in faith. David Clawson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
David Clawson. Find out more about the great work he does on Biblical Worldview. Go to TonyPerkins.com and check out the latest resources that David has made available in our Worldview section. All right, folks, we're out of time for today, but I want to thank you for joining us and remind you, 8 p.m. Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, pray, vote, stand. Will you take the pledge to pray, to vote, and, yes, stand? Just like the Apostle Paul says, you've done everything you can do. When you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.